2005. We have Robin Lamont, our LFO staff, with us, and also Catherine Bell, our good committee assistant. Today we have a hopefully a quick agenda where we're going to work through agency priorities and the 10% reduction list, and then for our committee of two, we'll be wrapping it up for the day. So come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, again, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And we are planning to talk about our prioritization of programs today. And in your notebook, you will see our prioritized list at tabs C and D. And the version at tab D is the Legislative Fiscal Office form, which includes program costs. What we've provided you at tab C, which you may actually find more useful as we're going through today, is the same list, hopefully the same programs in the same prioritized order, but including some data on high-level outcomes, which is what I'd like to talk about mostly today. And I did want to just make a couple of general comments about that data and some of the other areas that I'll be talking about. As I think we discussed yesterday, our performance measures, many of them are not aimed at high-level outcomes. They are aimed at intermediate-level outcomes. We do have data in some areas about high-level outcomes, but generally speaking, there are some challenges in measuring program effectiveness through this type of data. One reason being that although we influence outcomes, we do not control outcomes in many of those areas. For example, we work on ensuring that banks and insurance companies do not go insolvent, but the state of the economy has a lot to do with that as well. So I don't want to mislead you into thinking that an outcome that we show you is the exclusive result in our work. We do believe we influence those outcomes, and that is a part of, that is our role, and that is why we're discussing those issues. Another challenge for us is that many of our programs are aimed at prevention. We try to prevent fraud. We try to prevent a financial institution insolvency. We try to prevent worker illnesses and injuries. And proving the effectiveness of a prevention program is always somewhat of a challenge because how do you know what would have happened in the absence of that program? Again, that's just one of the challenges that we face. And in part because, and this is a comment I think also was made yesterday, we want to focus most of our energies on accomplishing our mission rather than on perfecting our data gathering. So we do actually tend to be fairly data rich as an agency, but there are areas where the data simply isn't as conclusive or illustrative as you might want to see for those reasons. One other point I want to make before getting into the prioritized list is that we have a lot of interrelated systems. And what we have done in the prioritized list, as we were asked to do, is to divide up our programs and prioritize them separately. But in many ways, that's a challenging exercise because the effectiveness of our ability to achieve a particular outcome may depend on having a range of programs or a range of tools. So I just want to flag that, and I'll flag some of those interrelationships as we go through. As I mentioned during my overview presentation a few days ago, in doing our prioritization, we used several different criteria. We first went through and divided our programs into three tiers. And the first tier were those programs which we felt strongly supported our mission and the governor's budget principles and serve a broad spectrum of Oregon's population. And for the most part, these are programs which also have measurable results and indicia of success. Our Tier 2 programs are often those that serve a smaller segment of the population than those in this first tier, but also strongly support our mission and the governor's budget principles. And those programs in our third tier, and I'll indicate those as we're going through, fall into actually two different categories. Some of them are very small programs which have which often don't have measurable results, and others in this category are programs which, while very important, could potentially be performed by others, local governments or the private sectors. And then within, particularly within the first tier, we tried to prioritize based on the seriousness of harm that Oregonians would face if the functions weren't effectively performed, and also the breadth of the programs, that is, how many Oregonians they affect. And as I said during our original discussion, these are obviously subjective. Your prioritization may vary. Your criteria may vary, but at least we wanted to lay out for you how we went at this exercise. So the prioritized list, then, starting at if you're looking at the list on tab C, the program that we rated highest was Oregon OSHA enforcement efforts. And I want to talk about this one a little because it illustrates some of those issues concerning data, and also because it's the first one of the programs that are in that interrelated cluster of safety and workers' compensation programs. And some questions, some good comments were made when we discussed this program initially about, first of all, how do we know what is due to safety? And secondly, how do we know what the difference would be if we had a federal program which didn't require a contribution of state funds. With respect to that that issue of the contribution to safety, I actually brought some additional information which may be of interest to you. There have been two studies commissioned by the legislature at various times about how much do different factors contribute to the workers' compensation system, reduction in rates and safety improvements. And again, any study can be repeated, and I can't vouch for the how accurate to the percentage point it is, and I'm not going to try to do that. But I just wanted to relate to you those two studies, the one which was completed in 1996, which found that of the reduction in workers' compensation rates, roughly one-tenth was due to stricter compensability standards, roughly one-tenth was due to a less hazardous employment mix, between a third and a half was due to increased safety, and the remainder due to other elements. The second study, which was dated October 2000, showed that approximately one-third of the change in the period studied, which was a later post-1995 period, approximately one-third of the change after that period was due to changes in statutes dealing with the workers' compensation system, about two-thirds due to enhancements in safety and a cluster of activities, including return-to-work programs, competitiveness of the insurance market, and so on. So we have given you, and we often talk about, the cumulative savings of over $10 billion for Oregon employers, the increased safety rates, but as you know, those are due to a multiplicity of factors. But I think we can say with confidence that safety is a very significant contributor, perhaps the most significant contributor to those outcomes. Now, safety, again, is not entirely, by any means, due to the efforts of Oregon OSHA. As I mentioned, we've seen increases in safety through increased emphasis by employers, by insurance companies. There are national trends outside of Oregon. Many states have experienced significant improvement in safety. The issue of a state plan versus a federal plan. I can tell you that Oregon has done well, very well, in terms of safety improvements, but I can't tell you that a state plan always does better than a state with a federal plan. That's not the case. There are some federal plan states that also do very well. Nevertheless, having a state plan, I think, adds very significantly to Oregon's programs. And I want to come back to the two parts of our mission, to protect and serve Oregon's consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate. And what our local program does is it strongly affects the way in which we achieve safety outcomes and the way in which we work with Oregon businesses. Pete DeLuca, when he was discussing this issue last week, mentioned as an example Oregon's logging rules, which are unique to Oregon situations. We have several other major areas where through working with local business, we have developed standards that are very suitable to Oregon and achieve at least as good or better safety outcomes in areas such as industrial health in the construction trades, one of our major factors in our employment, in our economy here in Oregon, in respiratory protection, for example. In addition, and this will come into play in particular when I talk about our voluntary services, which is number 10 on our priority list, we do take a different approach to our safety program than in a federal state. Federal Region 10, which covers Oregon, Washington, Alaska, and Idaho. Idaho is a federal plan state, and federal OSHA also provides safety services for federal installations in that entire region. So that would be federal prisons, military installations, maritime facilities, and so on. The federal program is exclusively compliance officers. Our program is compliance staff who also provide compliance assistance as part of their compliance duties, and consultants and training staff. We do many more inspections. We don't fine as heavily. We focus on achieving compliance. When I meet with business leaders, very often the comment that I'll get from them regarding how Oregon OSHA behaves is, I had an inspection, I was worried, but those guys were really helpful. They taught me a lot about safety. That's exactly what we deliver through having a state plan. So I believe there are significant benefits. There are obviously costs associated with it as well, but nevertheless, that is why it ranks highest on our list. And I have spent a fair amount of time with it, again, because that's a key component of our larger workers' compensation system. The second element on our priorities list is also part of the workers' compensation system, and this is our coverage efforts. The goal of this program is to ensure that Oregon employers provide workers' compensation insurance for their employees, and this is really the benefit of the workers' comp bargain. The workers' comp bargain with Oregon workers is that in exchange for not having access to the civil justice system, they get workers' compensation coverage. And in order to deliver that coverage, number one is employers have to provide workers' compensation insurance or self-insurance. So that's why this program is up here at number one. The rest of the workers' compensation system breaks down if employers don't provide coverage. And incidentally, if we have non-compliance by employers, that means the rest of the system picks up those costs, because those workers are entitled to the coverage regardless. So this is not the timely and accurate benefits. This is the basic provision of insurance coverage. Number three is statewide building codes. And this, again, is not the service portion. This is not permits and inspections. This is actual development of statewide building codes. And we've given you a little bit of data here. Again, building codes are a prevention mechanism. We have given you some information from the National Conference of States and Building Codes and Standards, which is the national entity that looks at this type of issue. They strongly support consistent state building code systems as opposed to local building codes, and they point to Hurricane Andrew in 1992 as an example where they believe that between 30% and 40% of the $15 billion losses associated with that event could have been prevented by good statewide building code system, which were not in place at the time. So, again, it's prevention, but we believe strongly that a statewide system of building codes does protect Oregonians. Number four on our list is insurance financial regulation. And insurance is state-regulated throughout the country. There is not a federal option. So, again, this is the basic financial regulation that ensures that insurance companies who do business in Oregon will be there to provide benefits for their insureds if there's a question. And as you heard from Mr. Ario when he testified, that's the basic. You don't have insurance regulation without some assurance that the company is going to be there. Again, there is a backup system, just like in workers' compensation. If insurance isn't provided, the rest of us pay. The Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association does step in if an insurance company is insolvent, but what that really means is that all of us who buy insurance step in, because those costs are then passed along to the insurance buying public. Number five and six are, again, fairly fundamental regulatory structures, and these are banks and credit unions. Now, for banks and credit unions, again, there is a federal alternative, but it's the state-chartered institutions that provide the basic services to Oregon communities. There have been 22 new banks formed in Oregon in the last 10 years. All of them chose a state charter instead of a federal charter. There are 297 state bank offices, branches in Oregon. 169 of those are from out-of-state banks. So again, the majority of the of your local bank is are state chartered banks, and there are reasons why having good state chartering system for banks is are important. A state charter is lower cost than a federal charter. There are more access to regulators to solve local problems. We use a risk-focused examination process as opposed to that sort of one-size-fits-all. So, again, this is a regulatory system that is more business-friendly, but it's also more friendly to consumers, those who use banking services. Generally, a local bank is more responsive to community needs. They can be more timely in responding to complaints. They generally have lending limits, which are more accommodating to the local economy. They know their customers. They can make decisions about when to lend in a way that a national bank might not be able to. They're able to make small loans in a way that a national bank might be reluctant to. So, much of the same can be said of credit unions. It was interesting to me to learn that 70% of Oregon's credit unions have been around for 50 years or more. So we have credit union structure here in Oregon that's a very, very long-standing one, and those are state-chartered credit unions. We have not had a federally chartered credit union open the doors here in quite some time. We're now moving back to insurance for a moment, and our next priority program, number 7 on our list, is the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. This is actually number 7 and 8. We split out the claims delivery and the pool management. And as we talked about when Roger King was here, this Oregon Medical Insurance Pool serves one specific segment of Oregon's population. Part of that larger goal of reducing the number of uninsured in the state, the particular segments served here are those who have chronic health issues that prevent them from getting individual insurance in the private market, and people who can afford premiums, either themselves or through a subsidy program. But this is not the poverty program. This is essentially, and I think Representative Richardson, it may have been your comment, this is the equivalent of an assigned risk pool. People pay market rates, but then all of those of us who have health insurance chip in so that the insurance for this population is provided and is affordable.
Let me ask a quick question on that. And maybe you'll need to get back to me with the information. I'd be interested in knowing what the average monthly cost is for an enrollee. And let me tell you why I'm asking that question. I'm curious with how that compares with the average monthly cost of an Oregon health plan enrollee.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to get back to you on that. It actually is in the materials, but I'll pull it out for you. Are you interested in the premium that they pay or the actual cost of providing the service? Those are very different in the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool because there is an assessment that makes up the difference.
And I guess what I would ask is because I don't want to take time right now, is perhaps both. And
good.
Then
we'll be happy to do
that.
Yeah,
I'll cycle through that. Yeah.
Our ninth-ranked program is, again, workers' compensation, and this is the provision of benefits. And again, this is the part of the benefit of the bargain. The workers' compensation system, what the worker is entitled to is timely and accurate payment of benefits. We talked a little yesterday about how we do in Oregon in terms of timeliness and accuracy, but that's this program. Next on our list is number 10, which is the voluntary services component of Oregon OSHA. And I talked about this a little previously. This is the consultation and training portion, which is a unique feature of Oregon's program and part of why we think that it is a success. And I know I'm moving fairly rapidly, but I assume you will stop me if you have questions at any point. Number 11 on our list is the hearings division of the Workers' Compensation Board. The Workers' Compensation Board provides two levels of review. The administrative hearing before an administrative law judge, and then if that decision is appealed, that goes to the Workers' Compensation Board. Board review we've put on our list at number 20 because it's a smaller number of cases that go up to the board, but there is a large volume of cases that are resolved at the administrative hearings level. In fact, there are also many cases which are resolved before they even get to this level inside the Workers' Compensation Division. Alternative dispute resolution is more timely and less costly than reliance on the judicial system, and is one of the those components which together, I think, we believe lead to an effective workers' compensation system. Next is another workers' compensation component, and that is the Office of the Injured Workers Ombudsman. This is, although we're now into more of a provider element than the essential basic regulation, for injured workers, having access to help in navigating through the system is, we feel, a critical component in making the system work effectively. It is a complex system, and workers, part of the deal that was struck in the Mahonia Hall reforms was to ensure that workers had a place to go.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Ms. Reisinger, I'm very moved by your argument that needing the guide through is almost as important as the actual assistance. I may be projecting more onto what you said than you said, but your heavy emphasis on how important the guide is. Do you have a ratio that you determine open number of cases for people available? How do you correlate how many folks you need providing that on the ground or on the phone assistance to workers going through your system?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, there's actually two answers to that question. One of them is, I should point out that we also provide assistance to workers through the Benefits Consultation Unit in the Workers' Compensation Division. So the help available is not limited to the Injured Workers Ombudsman Office. But that said, the head of that office is fairly new, came on a little over a year ago, if I recall correctly, Travis Wall, and we are, I've asked him to put together a business plan, business case, essentially, for how should we determine those staffing levels. So that's a work in progress. We do not have that formula right now, but one of the issues is, what is the appropriate staffing level? That's an issue you deal with on a regular basis. It has been historically not set based on any ratio, but rather based on a service delivery expectation that we can get back to workers within a certain period of time and respond to their concerns within a certain period of time. But that's easier said than done, because part of the issue about how much time do you have to spend on a complex case, and how much energy can you put into assisting a worker on a complex case.
Mr. Chair, if you'd allow an observation, it seems to be, even in this early stage of the budget process, an emerging theme in some of the budgets that we've heard, that citizens seeking assistance in accessing the programs is an overarching theme, and that there appear to be pockets of assistance located throughout state government for whether it's a veterans issue or an injured worker issue, and that capable assistance with enough time to devote to helping the citizen is almost as valuable as the programmatic outcome is. And it might be something that we as a body would want to look into, to just figure out how to get those knowledgeable guides to access what already exists.
Great. I'm writing that down.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we'll touch on a few of those other assistance programs as we go through. In fact, the next one is Insurance Division, Consumer Protection Market Regulation. This is actually not, we have two insurance programs listed here that deal with direct consumer protection. This one deals with essentially market trends and examination of insurance company behavior on the large scale. We actually go in and do examinations, and this is the area where if we see an inappropriate pattern of conduct by an insurance company, where we will use enforcement tools to address it. We will get to in a moment in number 16, the consumer help, the consumer advocacy element for insurance markets generally, as opposed to workers' compensation. And on the program that we've got listed, it's number 16, there again we have an advocacy staff who work with individual consumers on resolving complaints. Although less element here of working your way through the system as a more of a traditional complaint resolution role. Moving back for a moment then to number 14 is securities regulation. And here our goal is promotion of capital formation, but also prevention of fraud. And we do, unfortunately, spend a fair amount of time in this area tracking down scams and dealing with them when they need to be dealt with. The number 15 is in the building codes area, and this is the quality assurance portion of building codes, in a sense. This is licensing of trades, plumbers, electricians, and so on, and also the licensing of inspectors. Again, this is an area where performing this function at a statewide level is part of the goal of ensuring consistency, even when inspections and permitting is often performed at the local level. We already touched briefly on number 16, which is the Insurance Division Consumer Services section. Numbers 17 and 18 are two of our smaller programs relating to financial services. Number 17 is consumer finance, and this is the area that includes payday and title loans. Number 7 is mortgage lending. And these are the access to credit services for Oregonians in many areas where credit is needed, but also areas where there is a potential for abuse. I wanted to mention, and this, again, is a combination of regulation and also prevention of harm. I wanted to mention an example in the mortgage lending area this past year. In Yamhill County, we were very actively engaged in investigating and responding to a situation where there were allegations of illegal mortgage lending process practices targeting the Latino community. It was essentially a scam that cost dozens of Spanish-speaking households their life savings, and that has resulted in arrest and indictment of 8 individuals. So these situations can range from fairly minor to fairly significant and major, and in this particular instance, one of the concerns and one of the areas we spent a fair amount of time on was assuring that that Latino community did not feel threatened by dealing with law enforcement. If we are dealing with victims who may have issues regarding documentation or fear of authority for various reasons, we want to not have that stand in the way of being able to shut down fraud. And we have, in conjunction with that, also engaged in some good educational activities aimed at the Latino community in the Valley.
Mr. Chair.
Please, Senator.
I want to just ask you a question in your observation. Do you think that we've become very lax, however, in allowing different kind of financial, whether it's mortgage or whether it's payday loans or what, to go into business where they actually can prey on people that are in high need of some kind of financial assistance? And it just seems to me that everywhere I look, it used to be, you know, you just had to go down to the banker and get the money. And now we have all of these various places, and people get desperate and are taken advantage of, and then you see it after the complaints come in. Do you also see it up front where people are going into business and yet you can see that they would take advantage of people?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, one of the things we do through these licensing programs is we do set standards up front. And we require financial responsibility, and we also look into the background of the individuals involved. And we, through our regulations and through the laws that you've passed, also have substantive standards about conduct that is and is not appropriate. But it is certainly a challenge, because even a program that is in full compliance with the law may be charging fees and interest rates that have the effect of creating a financial hardship for an individual. And we do not currently in Oregon, and have not for quite some time, had laws which restrict interest rates. And one of the challenges is that we do have also a population who need to have access to money for emergencies on occasion. If someone is living paycheck to paycheck and then has a medical emergency or a child issue with a child or car breaks down, they may not have alternatives. one of our goals is to make sure that there are alternatives, including a range of affordable alternatives, and that people have information about what those alternatives are. In the payday lending area, for example, providing consumer information has been one of our goals. Ensuring that regulatory standards are, in fact, met is one of our goals. This subcommittee last session asked us to report back on increased enforcement efforts in the payday and title lending areas. We have, in fact, increased our enforcement efforts. We've also been, for example, we have worked with the credit union industry to offer payday loan alternatives, so that if you are a credit union member for a number of our larger credit unions now, you can get the equivalent of a payday loan, but at an interest rate that is more like 15% or 18%, instead of a fee that could be the equivalent of several hundred percent.
Mm. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your investigation, do you ever ask for their loss experience ratio? And what's behind my question is these payday loans are usurious. I mean, the interest rates are really high, and they take advantage of people, in my judgment. Generally, high risk equals high interest. But, in fact, do they have that much high risk? And do you have any way of knowing when you license and regulate them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, you're asking for the criteria for licensure of the business initially?
Well, I'm just curious if in your relationship with these businesses, do you understand, in fact, what their loss really is, which then would justify the rates that they charge?
They are very profitable, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris. Floyd Lanter, who's the head of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, has come forward, and I'm going to ask him very briefly to tell you what we look at when we license an institution.
With your pleasure,
please,
Mr. Chair.
Please, yes. Chair Smith, Senator Morris. Two issues here. First, with respect to the licensing, obviously we look to the experience of the management proposing to go into business in Oregon. There are no capital standards, but they do have to present a business plan and have experienced operators, such as to command the confidence of Oregonians that the business will be operated safely and soundly. Secondly, you asked about the loss experience. Once they're into the industry, they provide us an annual report that gives us some basic information on their loss experience. And yes, it is high, but I can say from the information that we receive, it does not exceed loss ratios, for example, of credit card banks, which tend to run about 6 or 7%.
Something to work on, Mr. Chairman. I would go with that, but...
Yeah, it's an interesting issue. We've had these discussions. I think in order for something to move forward, we're going to need to bring the credit union community and the banking community along with the advocacy groups together and try and find a compromise that will work. There's definitely an issue there.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, we actually did a fairly extensive review of the payday lending industry during this past interim, and we'd be happy to provide you with a copy or any members who'd be interested in that.
Would be. Thank you.
Yeah, I think I'd be beneficial for everyone on the committee to see.
Moving along on our prioritized list, we're now into the category which, while they are still in our first tier, are more of the service provider elements rather than the straight regulatory functions. And number 19 on our list is the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, which you've heard from fairly extensively, which supports a positive business climate by working with all state agencies as well as ours. It is a little bit different than most of our programs in that it is that sort of internal government functions and focusing on the business climate and making regulatory systems easier for business. Number 20 on our list, I had also mentioned previously, and that is the Workers' Compensation Board. So this is the second level of dispute resolution within that agency. Number 21 and number 22 we discussed fairly extensively during our previous couple of days. These are two of the three programs that the Office of Minority, Emerging, and Women-Owned Small Businesses certifies. The first one, the DBE program, is the federally mandated program. DBE certifications, or disadvantaged business enterprise certifications, we are required to certify firms in those categories in order to qualify for various types of federal transportation funding. The second program listed here, number 22, is one of two state programs. This is the minority and women-owned business program for local jurisdictions and state jurisdictions that set aside or target contracting opportunities for those traditionally disadvantaged groups. The emerging small business, which is race and gender neutral, is the third program, and we have prioritized that slightly lower on our list simply because those are not in that core group of traditionally disadvantaged. Number 23 on our list is another workers' compensation program. This is the cluster of reemployment assistance programs or return to work programs. I think we had a question about those a little possibly yesterday when we were talking about our performance measures. We showed you in our performance measures that those return to work programs actually do a very measurable job and good job in increasing wage replacement for injured workers. We had one study in 1998 of workers who had used these return to work programs over the past 5 years. During that five-year period, this group of workers had earned an estimated $108 million more than similarly disabled workers who had not used the program. So this does create real wage replacement. We were, I believe, you, Mr. Chair, may have asked, how do these compare with programs in other states? Is that a good outcome comparatively? Actually, these programs are unique to Oregon. Most states have vocational assistance programs, but these return to work programs were a feature of the Oregon Workers' Compensation System reforms that many other states, while they are have asked us about them and they often envy the results, they have not figured out a way to fund. California just adopted some of these programs in their major reforms last year, but they have not implemented them for lack of funding. Washington has a small preferred worker program similar to ours, but less extensive. Other than that, Oregon is alone in having these successful programs.
Senator Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do injured workers seem to be able to go back to work or find a job easier than those in my area? We have people that have been retrained. They are not injured. They simply were unemployed because of the complete closure of a business, whether it was the Weyerhaeuser mill, and they've been retrained two and three times and still cannot find employment because there's not a job bank there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, that is a challenge for any worker who's gone through retraining, and that is one of the issues that these return-to-work programs attempt to address. They actually provide incentives for employers to hire these workers, and the incentives include payment of workers' compensation premiums. They include technology that will assist the worker in overcoming any disability, for example, performing a job that couldn't be performed without some lifting assistance. So the programs are aimed at making these workers attractive to prospective employers. And one of our challenges is always to continue to make sure we find that many workers and employers don't know about these programs and aren't using them as extensively as they could. One of our legislative proposals, actually, that came out of some interim work by the Management Labor Advisory Committee will be to make these programs more usable because we feel that they actually do provide significant value in overcoming the barriers that you just identified.
Question for you. Can you provide us with a little bit of 101 on the history of why these type of programs aren't in the employment department? And please let me tell you the perspective I have. I'm visualizing myself in the situation of a citizen who would utilize these programs, walking through the door of the employment department as the very first place they're going to go, and then I see them being told to go this direction or that direction, and I'm trying to figure out why they all wouldn't be centralized together.
Mr. Chair, we can get back to you with more information on how we coordinate with the employment department, but I will say someone who is in the workers' compensation system is already in our door. and information is supposed to be provided to them by their workers' compensation insurer, so that they're not in a position of having to go find the help. But again, part of our goal is to make sure that that information is getting effectively into the right people's hands. In addition, at least one of these programs, it's the employer who needs to initiate it, and that seems to, in some cases, be a barrier. We want the worker to be able to essentially carry the program benefits from employer to employer and shop them around if need be. Well, we do try to coordinate.
That's great. Previously, I talked about some other coordinating efforts. I think this is one where, just for my own need, I may want to try and bring a couple directors together and anyone from the committee who would like to sit in, just to understand how these all link together. Because I keep thinking about job training programs with the community colleges. I'm thinking of vocational tech. I'm thinking of the employment department services and also yours. And I know they're different, but I think at some point I'm going to want to set up an appointment and work with you and a couple other directors to walk through that. Sandra Johnson.
Mr. Chair, just because you've opened the door, a subset to that meeting might be a review of the expectations from some of these retraining programs. I know some of them are very valuable and have a very high success rate. Others that I've been familiar with, particularly back when I ran an aviation company and we were teaching people how to fly, would be to have an injured worker come very late in their life and want to be trained as a helicopter pilot. And I think Representative Richardson would bear out that training up a new helicopter pilot at age 55 probably is not optimal to get a return on the investment for that level of training.
Is that a pejorative comment about those of us who are 55?
No, it is a very positive comment about Representative Richardson's expertise in a certain area.
And knowledge is something for younger guys.
Well, Corey, let me ask you this question. What would it take to coordinate with the employment department and the other partners? And I say other because I'm not sure who all of
Mr. Chair, would you have to facilitate a meeting?
I'd really like to try and put something together to come before this committee and talk about all of the different training programs and show us the success and the challenges. I hope you'd be able to show us both those that are out there, and maybe even bring a couple folks to the table to share with us their experience.
May I add to that? Please. One thing that we'd like to see is whether or not the job training includes training for jobs that will never really pay enough to do them much good. I mean, cosmetology is a great profession for some people, but if you look at average incomes from it, it isn't designed to bring in a lot of, it doesn't provide family wage-paying jobs and a lot of tax revenue and those kinds of things. And so we'd like to see what kind of jobs are actually being trained as well.
Yeah, really, really quick, let me tell you what I visualize on this. I visualize an employee standing right here and a group of different folks with different programs and services, and then having you folks tell us the scenarios under which that person may go there, that person may go there, that person may go there, and then letting us know how they all coordinate together.
We'll be happy to facilitate that, Mr. Chair, and obviously some of those programs are in our department, but we can certainly get in touch with the other people who should be at the table and pull that together.
That would be really appreciated. Representative Avakian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe just to help hone that conversation, because I know what you're being asked to do is in some ways going over 20 years of development in workers' compensation and voc rehab law, with this legislature spent throughout the 80s and 90s a considerable amount of time on. Many of the statutes and administrative rules that govern you dictate which jobs people get placed in and what the responsibilities are, for instance, getting somebody within 20% of the wage they were earning prior to the time they were injured and such. And maybe what can help guide that discussion is what parameters you have by rule and law in providing the service.
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, certainly we can do a little 101 if that would be helpful. And I would say this is we should be fairly well prepared to do that, because we did do this a fairly extensive review of voc rehab and return to work programs just recently, trying to identify, are there areas where improvement is needed. One of the areas, for example, is shortening the time for a worker to get into one of these programs and get through it. And we found that there were some proposals which needed to be made to shorten that time. So happy to follow up on that.
Thank you. That's excellent.
That was number 23 on our priority list, and number 24 is the last of what we were identifying as our Tier 1 programs, and this is retroactive and supplemental benefits for injured workers. These are a number of different situations, but primarily ones where the worker should be entitled to the benefits, but for one reason or another, it is not appropriate or fair for the employer or insurance company to pay those directly. This may be, for example, where a worker was injured some time ago and benefits have improved since then. The worker gets the improved benefits, but those come out of our workers' benefit fund. So that this is that the program under which those benefits are provided. The Tier 2 programs, as I mentioned, are also important to our accomplishment of our mission, but often either serve lesser populations or are not as fundamental. And the first one of these is actually revenue collection, which is in workers' compensation. And this is part of what was our number two priority program, ensuring that employers have workers' compensation coverage. This is the other side of that. If an employer does not provide workers' compensation coverage, we go after them. And we also assess all players in the system for the funding for this for these various programs. So this is the level playing field, that everybody pays their share. The next program, number 20.
Sorry, Representative Morris, or Senator Morris, excuse me.
Not a problem.
There's a compliment.
Is there any potential overlap with the revenue department in your collection and enforcement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, for collections, statutorily there is an interplay between our department and revenue. We get the first crack, and then after a certain period of time, they run a collections program. We find, as I think many agencies find, that the sooner collections activity can be started, the better. So for actual collections of accounts receivable, we make an aggressive effort to collect those ourselves. In terms of the assessments, there is a combined revenue, employment, and workers' compensation, combined reporting forms, essentially. So the three agencies work together so that the various payroll-related taxes and assessments are, in fact, coordinated. And we are working on trying to get those even further coordinated. Right now, I believe you get one form, but you have to fill out three parts of the form. We would like to actually have one form to fill out, for example. Does that respond to your question?
Yes. Thank you.
I'd like to ask a follow-up question on that. Earlier today in general government, we had the revenue department before us, and one of the issues I raised to them was trying to provide information to lending institutes when companies are delinquent on, in this case it was the income tax or payroll tax. And I'd like to now ask this question of you. How do we provide notification to a lender that perhaps a company is not current on its workers' comp insurance?
Mr. Chair, I have no idea, but we can get back to you on that.
And let me tell you where I'm going with this question.
See people taking notes, but nobody is rushing forward to answer the question.
Well, let me tell you where I'm going with that. Quite often, especially in small communities with community banks, when a small business is looking for a line of credit or any type of loan, for that matter, the bank runs a credit check, and then they will they'll do what's called a UCC search.
Mm-hmm.
And the bank will go on that information as its source of information to verify information provided to them. But so often, workers' comp insurance and payroll and income taxes are not paid. There's an obligation outstanding, and in many cases, the state of Oregon is trying to collect money on those, and yet lenders out in the lending community have no clue this is going on. And so somehow there's got to be an information process to protect the lending community about these, in many cases, significant debts that are owed.
Mr. Chair, that's a good point and a good question, and as I said, I don't know the answer, but we can certainly get back to you. I know that we do have a couple of collection tools which would show up through a search of lien records, for example, but I don't know at what stage a collection actually gets to one of those publicly available sources.
Yeah, it doesn't get reported until a judgment has been issued, but quite often that could be 9 months, a year, and a lot of lending activity occurs prior to that. Thank you.
Next on our list, we're now at number 26. This is Building Code's training function. This is training for the licensed trades. It enhances compliance. The next item on this list, number 27, is another portion of the workers' compensation system. This is the Small Business Ombudsman. The Small Business Ombudsman's role is to assist small business through the workers' compensation system. Most of the effort here is focused in a couple of different areas. One of them is obtaining insurance, because as I think you may be aware, for a very small business, there are options for obtaining workers' compensation. Insurance may be limited. The other one is assisting small business in ensuring that premium categories are calculated correctly. In other words, premiums for workers' compensation are based on the classification of your workers, and it can often be complex to figure out for a small business whether the assessment is being based on the most favorable classification. The next program is another one of our financial programs. This is pre-needs funeral trusts. And although, generally speaking, compliance in this area is high, this is also an area where people entrust a third party with their money with the expectation that services will be available when needed and at a time when you really don't want to find out that at a time when you're dealing with loss, that your financial assets are in jeopardy as well. We actually had a major case during this biennium of a pre-needs provider who had, we believe, misappropriated funds, and there were people who were injured by that. We were successful in getting those funds reimbursed and in providing some protection there. So although this is a small program, from time to time, it does require regulatory action.
Next question.
Representative Richardson.
I'm looking through my materials to try and see what how you define that as far as a small program. Are we talking about a few hundred thousand dollars or a few million dollars?
There are 208 pre-arranged funeral trust providers and 78 endowment care facilities who are regulated by this program.
Okay.
If you are looking for the budgetary effect, if you look at the spreadsheet that is in tab C, I'm sorry, tab D, I beg your pardon, this program should show up under number 28 on the list.
Okay, thank you.
Number 29 on our list is dispute resolution within the Workers' Compensation Division. And as I mentioned, many, many cases are resolved at the department level without even going to the Workers' Compensation Board. And this is an element of, we believe, what makes the workers' compensation system work smoothly. Again, this alternative dispute resolution not only provides low-cost resolution, but also faster, which for the worker as well as the employer is a benefit.
Really quick, can you provide us information on the history of why this dispute resolution wasn't put in with the dispute resolution group within the employment department?
Mr. Chair, I believe Maureen Bach addressed this very briefly, but the central hearings panel at the employment department was created to respond to a concern that hearings officers were not independent of the agency whose cases they heard. The Workers' Compensation Board, however, is a standalone agency. We provide that agency with administrative support, but it is independent. Maureen Bach is appointed by the governor and does not report to me from a programmatic standpoint. So because the volume was large, the specialties already existed, and therefore the economies of scale because it's a large entity, and because the independence already existed, that was specifically carved out of the central hearings panel. This alternative dispute resolution is pre-hearing, so these are not hearings in this particular program, but the Workers' Compensation Board hearing process is a formal administrative law judge process.
Thank you. That really helps me. Thank you.
I believe we are now down to program number 30, which is, again, in our Tier 2. This is the last of the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business Certification Programs. This is the Emerging Small Business Program. Again, an important program, but 659 businesses are certified through this program, and again, simply because the sort of core of this entity's work is those traditionally disadvantaged groups, this one we rank slightly lower. That brings us to our third tier of programs. And again, these fall into a couple of different categories. The first two are building codes programs. The statewide services, which are the inspections and permitting in three substantive areas, elevators and escalators, boilers and pressure vessels, and manufactured and housing and prefab structures. I want to make a couple of points here. First of all, these are highly important functions. They are critical to safety. The reason that we have placed them lower on our priority list is that they could be performed by others, not that they are not highly important. These services can be provided by contract inspectors, for example, and in some areas, in fact, they are already provided by non-governmental parties as part of insurance requirements. So, for example, an insurance company might provide its own inspection services.
Let me ask you a question. What would we gain if we were to ever go with that option? What would we have?
Mr. Chair, we believe the services are provided consistently and on a high-quality basis the way that they're provided now. We are not recommending in any way, shape, or form changing that, but for a prioritization purpose, we did look at, are there things which we could not do?
Are there other states that contract?
I believe there are. I think, Mark, you want to come up for a moment?
Good afternoon.
Howdy.
Your question is if there are other states that provide inspection services.
Please
in these areas?
Yourself for the record.
Sure, I'm sorry. Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes Division. The question is, are there other states that provide these inspection services? And the answer is yes. In Oregon, just in boiler inspections and pressure vessel, about 60% of this state is already covered by insurance agents. We cover the other 40%. In other states, insurance agents provide elevator inspections. The state doesn't have a direct inspection role. And then with manufactured housing, that is a federal program, and under the federal guidelines, private inspection outfits perform those inspections as well. I think California does that. It varies from state to state. So, again, that's why we put it on the list, is there are other models out there for carrying out these services.
So, in your opinion, what's the benefit of having it in-house?
Mr. Chair, obviously consistency of service, coordination with the other programs is the primary benefit, and that's why the state carries out those services. But again, not to reiterate Director Streisinger's comments, we simply were looking at what could be done by others, and these are clearly examples that are out there for your consideration.
Perfect.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And, Mr. Chair, the next program is also a building codes program with a similar explanation, actually. These are the inspections in areas where we are the provider of last resort. It is a local option. In many jurisdictions, many parts of the state, local government provide inspections and permitting services, but in areas where local governments choose not to, we provide them instead. And that is simply the way that our statutes have been set up. And because local governments could provide these, we have, again, put that in our third tier prioritization list. I do, again, want to stress this is not a recommendation. We were actually asked by this subcommittee last biennium to look at different models of service delivery for building codes. and to do so in conjunction with our stakeholders. And we spent, and Mr. Long spent quite a bit of time working with our stakeholders during this biennium to look at alternate models. We have provided the report in response to that. It was a budget note, actually. We have provided a report in response to that budget note. And what I can tell you is that although there was a lot of very good discussion about the challenges and about different models, there was no consensus among stakeholders. Different stakeholders would be affected in different ways by any change in service delivery model. So although there were some minor recommendations that came forward, there was not a recommendation for a significant change in service delivery. The next sets of programs are ones that serve much smaller populations. The first one is number 33. This is regulation of collection agencies and credit service organizations and debt consolidators. This is not an area where we see significant complaints. Again, there is always a risk there, and this we're, again, not recommending this program for elimination, but as part of a prioritization process, some programs do need to be near the bottom of the list, and that is why you see this one here. Money transmitters as well, number 34, we have not seen significant complaints, but money transmitters do handle a great deal of financial transactions, and it is another program that we do regulate. Next on the list is pawnbrokers. Pawnbrokers have attracted quite a bit of attention at various times during the legislative sessions. This is number 35 on our list. We actually did a fairly extensive review of pawnbrokers this time because we wanted to get a good sense of whether or not statewide regulation of this program was needed. What we found is that the regulation of pawnbrokers is, in one sense, financial because pawnbrokers are being entrusted with property, but actually more significant concerns have to do with public safety and concerns about the fencing of stolen goods. And a lot of county sheriffs are concerned that pawnbroking be regulated. There is a unregulated similar set of businesses, sometimes called buy-sell shops, which do raise some concerns, and some local jurisdictions have regulation. So the alternate regulatory model here would be local regulation. But one of the challenges there is that a local regulation that stops at a city boundary or a county line simply encourages providers to set up on the other side of that line, and where the concern is potentially with fenced goods, that is an argument in favor of statewide regulation as we have today.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, Representative Avakian.
I'm sorry if I missed this in the earlier presentation about this item, but do you have is there some kind of a mechanism set up between you and local law enforcement agencies to pass information back and forth?
I believe we do, but Floyd? We actually did have some good consultations with law enforcement when we did this review. So, again, Floyd Lanter from the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities.
Sure. And actually, I wasn't looking for the whole answer you might have given a few days ago, but just if there is something and if there isn't, is that something you're planning on doing?
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, we did not cover this program in great depth, if at all, during our prior presentation.
Chair Smith, Representative Avakian, that's correct. I did not touch on the pawnbroker program. It's one of our smaller programs. Pawnbrokers, by requirement, are required to interact with local police authorities on activities, and they the police regularly either collect the reports or come out and visit the shops to look at what might be potentially fenced items. So there's a regular interaction between the actual pawn shop and police authorities. And we, if the occasion or the need arose, yes, we would communicate with the police authority as well.
Okay, thanks.
So, I'm going to ask a follow-up on that really quick, sir. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, we do have a collection of intriguing programs in this area that most people probably don't even think about from day to day. And this is one of them.
We're thinking about them now.
Yeah,
exactly.
Which brings us to our next program. Number 36 is a voluntary registration of sellers of travel. We have one organization registered.
I'm just interested. $57,000 for one organization. This is exciting.
Number 37.
I book all my travel
agency. It's a good thing to regulate.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I believe that this program was arose out of some concerns having to do with a spring break wet T-shirt event on an airplane a number of years ago. And some concerns about sellers of travel in that regard.
Boy, is she being coy, Miss?
Yeah, if there's ever a time for some follow-up questions, maybe he should.
Moving right along.
He stays quiet the whole time till now.
The next program on our list, number 37, is actually a transfer of funds to the Center for Research on Occupational and Environmental Toxicology. This is related to OSHA programs. This is not a program that we run. We simply provide some funding. It is located at OHSU, and we do receive periodic reports of its activities. Again, we're not questioning the value, but simply as a matter of prioritization, we don't see as much value as a number of our other programs. The final two programs on our list, we are proposing to eliminate and have bills to do so in this legislative session. Therefore, they are last. Number 38 is the registration of electronic signature companies. Again, this is a voluntary registration. It does not in any way affect the use of electronic signatures in Oregon, but this provision was put into statute at a time when this was new, and as I understand it, it was felt that there might be a benefit to having a state imprimatur on companies engaged in the business of certifying electronic signatures. It has proved not to be necessary. And the final program is a registry of international trade consultants. Again, this is voluntary, and there is one registrant. So, again, those two we do have legislation proposed to eliminate. That is our presentation of our prioritized list, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you wanted us also to briefly review our 10% cut list. I can tell you that, generally speaking, it is similar to our prioritized list, but also has some elements of what's often referred to as thinning the soup. That is, it involves small reductions to a broader range of programs.
Representative Avakian.
Thank you. You broke these into three tiers, and I'm not sure what your criteria was or why the tiers even exist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, that essentially was a tool for us to be able to categorize in terms of our highest, next highest, and next highest overall categories. The prioritization criteria for dividing into those three tiers, which is set out in the materials, is that the priority one programs are those which have very broad impact, strongly support our mission and the governor's budget principles, and also have measurable indicia of success. The tier two programs are those which, while they also support our mission and the governor's budget principles, tend to support smaller populations, smaller impact. The tier three programs are in tier three for one of two reasons. Either that the services could be provided by someone else, and those would be those building codes programs, or that they are small programs without measurable impact. And again, that's just to give you some indication of the sort of first level of criteria that we used for our prioritization process.
Thank you. Because we're going to have to work with this budget, I think we should go through the reductions. Two areas I'd like to have us have you at least notify us of as it comes up is where there is program dollars, particularly in the workers' comp area, if you could let us know in those reductions if program dollars are going to be cut versus administration dollars. And then also I'd be very interested in knowing in throughout these programs, if as we're looking at the reductions, if there's going to be a cost shift from one entity paying a fee versus someone else who's going to end up paying a fee.
Mr. Chair, I'll try to cover those briefly. I will say, if you look at this, is, would be then tab E in the appendix in your notebook, is our 10% cut list. And as you can see, it starts with elimination of the programs that are at the end of our prioritization list. So that is the first section overall. The international trade consultants, electronic signatures, sellers of travel, pawnbrokers, money transmitters, collection agencies. The next program on number, which is number, see, I'm trying to figure out how best to, this is the bottom of the first page. These aren't numbered one through whatever, so forgive me as I sort of try to struggle through how to discuss these, but the one that's labeled...
Chairman.
Senator Moore.
I need to find the place.
Oh, okay. Sorry. We're on tab E.
Tab E in the appendix in your notebook.
Tab E. Very good.
Beg your pardon.
Excuse me. Thank you.
And I may also need to ask for some help from some of our folks here. So I don't know whether I could just ask, Greg, are you the right person to come up and walk through this if I start to stumble? The building codes, construction inspections, transfer of responsibility for electrical building inspections to Lane, Douglas, and Curry counties. And I'm not sure whether this is in part already accomplished or whether this would be a transfer. So some of these are expected then, and the through local choice. And Mark's answer was that the transfer to Lane County has occurred. The transfer to Douglas County is expected to occur, and we are working with Curry County. Curry County would be would not be voluntary at this point then. The next item, the statewide services, we had discussed. This would be a discontinuation of state inspections of boilers, elevators, and manufactured homes, and we would then expect the private sector to pick those up. The next item on the list is the ESB certification in the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business. Following that is a cut, but not elimination, of the dispute resolution services in the Workers' Compensation Division. This would be an elimination of the Medford Field Office, which would obviously reduce our customer service to people in the southern portion of the state, and it would reduce some of our other functions. This would be a cut in 11.5 FTE. The next item would be a cut, not elimination, but a cut of one position.
Senator Johnson.
How many customers would be affected by that $2 million cut?
I'm getting we're going to have to get back to you on that response.
The point that I'm trying to make here is if we have a fully staffed office with the lights on, sort of waiting for somebody to come through the door at a cost of $2 million, or whether or not there are 6,000 people served in a pretty modest office. I'm obviously speaking in certain hyperbole, but I want to get a sense of how many actual citizens would be affected by that cut.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we'll get back to you on this. I do want to point out that this is not exclusively, this cuts the Medford office, but also cuts additional staff, so we can break that out for you and show you the impact of each, the Medford field office, and then the additional cuts, if you'd like.
What I'm really trying to get at is how many persons are served that would not be served.
Okay.
And if I'm...
Oh, one sec here. Sorry. Why don't we go Representative Richardson and then Representative Bakken after that.
Actually, just to follow up on your comment, Senator, is, and would they have representation in another way? I mean, can this be done through telephone?
Thank you.
Or mail, rather than having to show up?
Thank you. That nuances what I'm asking. Thank you.
Representative Bakken.
And actually, I'm following up on that. I think, I'm guessing that getting rid of that hearings division, that the response would not be to provide a telephone or a written type of a hearings process in Southern Oregon, which is different from that in the northern part of the state, that those people would end up having to drive to Eugene or Portland to have their hearings heard. So in addition to who wouldn't get services, how would they be displaced? Meaning what burden would be created on the other hearings division in the state? Because we may cut $2 million there, but have to pay $1 million in Portland and $1 million in Eugene to make up the difference and accommodate the people. So how does the displacement work?
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, I should clarify, this is not a hearings function. It's alternative dispute resolution.
Oh, okay.
But the point still stands, which is it's the squeezing the balloon issue. If, for example, we are able to resolve fewer disputes at this level, would that cause costs elsewhere in the system? So we will address that.
Representative Richardson.
And since we're going in a direction, what was the opportunity of conducting these alternative dispute resolution hearings using audiovisual real-time media, for instance, having the people in Medford be able to go to the community college or a number of locations that they have down there where they could appear and conduct a hearing without having to be face-to-face, but do it through real-time audiovisual, which is available all across the state.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, we can look at that as well. Again, if a cut in staff, there are two issues. Closing a location is one cost element.
That's rent.
This is right, but this is actually eliminating staff as well.
I guess it would come down to the effectiveness and just how busy your staff is across the state. I mean, are there areas where you have staff who could assume additional caseloads, who could carry additional caseloads from their location with people appearing using audiovisual real time?
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, in some of these areas, we will try to identify for you in this area, for example, what would be the service deterioration, what would be the delay, what would be the impact, and on how many people.
Thank you. Senator Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if we're sensitive enough to different areas of the state. If you're in Salem and you say you're going to close an office and you're going to move it to Portland, so what? You get on I-5 and you're there in 45 minutes, or if you're going to move something to Kaiser. But if you tell people in Coos Bay you're going to move them to Eugene, you've now said a big statement. That's in bad weather and in wintertime and driving conditions. Do they have a car? Are they able to pay to get to Eugene? I mean, you know, gas has been at $1.90. So I think that there is a sensitivity there that, for instance, coastal regions, people on the coast can get from one area of the coast. You can come from Curry County to Coos County a lot easier than you can go to Eugene. So I think there needs to be some sensitivity in numbers of people and how those locations and geographies work.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I want to be clear, we are not recommending these cuts. We have cut 16.5 positions this biennium over last biennium already. We are required to provide you with options for a 10% cut overall in our agency. That is a challenge for us to do because we continually look for cost savings which are already reflected in the budget from which we are asked to reflect an additional 10% cut. So we're very sensitive to that issue and to providing service to multiple parts of the state. We do have field offices for those reasons that you articulate. In addition, this particular cut would be considerably more than simply a closure of a specific office. It would affect 12 positions which are providing services generally. I don't know how many are in the Medford office, but this is considerably more than that office.
Mr. Chair, just
a follow-up
comment. I think that we spoke at Rural Oregon Day about connecting Oregon, and I would just like to point out the rural transit doesn't provide for people in Eastern Oregon to come to these areas or the coast to go to those areas in the valley as easily as people might think. Right. And so I just want to kind of lift this up as a good example of some of the reasons that we need so much to look at connecting all of us together.
Well, I think this discussion has been very good, and as Robin just pointed out to me, under the process that we're moving towards, or moving through, these are the type of discussions we're going to have, and these are the type of decisions we're going to need to make, particularly in human services and education and public safety. So this has been a good training ground. Thunder Morse.
Recognizing that this whole discussion about program elimination and reduction in expenses within agencies, general fund, discretionary funds versus other funds, and should, since we're focusing on, you know, most critically on the general fund side, should other funds be cut in the same way? You know, that discussion is really in a continuum, and whether that's good public policy or not, I don't know. But recognizing that that discussion is ongoing, my question to you is one that you may want to think on and then maybe come back. But assuming that that this is going to be a more universal, wide, across state government, figure out how we're going to re-engineer and do things differently for other fund agencies as well. If we were to tell you that we want to take an $8 million reduction in DCBS, but the provision is that we don't want to cut any services, okay? No service reduction, but we want to find $8 million. And we provided you with, in the context of the savings of $8 million, we provided you $500,000 of outside consultants to help you come in and essentially remap, re-engineer, and figure out how we can reduce those costs. Is that something that's possible to do?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I have to say I would question whether that's possible to do, and you're probably tired of agencies saying that to you, but process improvement is something we actually spend a lot of time and energy on internally, and the reason you see our FTE count shrinking as our caseloads grow is because we take that pretty seriously. So we can cut service, we can cut most of what we do is people, most of our ability to cut is people. And most of our people are out there delivering service. So I don't want to say there's not a positive answer to what you're saying, but I also I have to say I think we try pretty hard to do that internally and have been successful in doing so over time and in looking for areas where, in fact, we can get out of a particular area. Over the course of, if you look back a number of biennia, you will see this agency has shrunk because we identify program areas that we do not have to perform, and we then seek legislative approval to not perform those anymore. Again, we're not perfect, and I am perfectly willing to believe that there are folks who can come up with things we haven't thought of, and I'd love to have those discussions. But the examples that we've given you of those building codes programs, for example, those are areas which we believe there are alternate methods of service delivery, and that's why we have presented them to you in that form. Again, that's probably, you're probably rolling your eyes and saying, oh, the agencies always say that, and I apologize if that's the impression that I leave you with, but I do want to make sure that you know that we actually take that very seriously internally as well.
Well, thank you. I do appreciate your response, and I know that there has been effort within your agency to figure out ways to do it better, and I appreciate that. But the question remains, and that's the question I guess we're going to sort out, is to do we, you know, in some ways shoot ourselves in the foot, break the connectivity to Oregon, and maybe actually damage our ability to service business and industry in the state by arbitrarily taking a 10% cut in something that's totally other funds driven.
Again, this is a statutory requirement, and so we're going through this exercise. I don't think Corey's recommending these reductions, and these are discussions that we'll have as we go through this. One thing that would be very helpful, though, I think, for this committee is if you or your staff could provide us with just a list of all the different sources of other funds and where they come from. And
500.
Yeah, and line them up. And I don't think we need a presentation on it, but just provide us with that information and help us see where those other funds, what they fund.
Mr. Chair, would be happy to do that. Do you want me to continue going through our... We are on page 2, I believe, and about two-thirds of the way down the page, we had just discussed the Workers' Compensation Division dispute resolution program. The next one on this page is Workers' Compensation revenue collection. I did talk about that assessment program. This would eliminate a position, and it is something that we are exploring internally. One of the cautions here is whether it would reduce that interagency cooperation with employment and revenue on that combined tax reporting system. So, again, there are consequences, but this is an area that we do intend to look at to see whether there are efficiencies to be gained. The next item on this list is Workers' Compensation Board, and the board is that highest level of review. It's a 5-member board. This proposal has been considered by the legislature before. It would eliminate 2 of those 5 positions and have a 3-member board instead of a 5-member board. The issue here is that it could create a backlog in cases. Those board members sit in panels right now. They don't. I think Ms. Bach told you when she was before you last week that they sit in bank only in some fairly rare cases, that for the most part they do their work in 2-person panels. So this would be a cut in people performing that work. And the specific area that Ms. Bach raises when this issue comes up is that the way the board is structured, there are 2 members who are required to have a labor background and 2 members who are required to have a management background, and one of each sits on each case, and then Ms. Bach, who is the neutral, is the tiebreaker. There are cases, situations, where one member or another has a conflict of interest and cannot sit on a particular case. For example, a labor member, due to previous employment, might not be able to sit on a case. Having a 5-member board, she believes is important to avoid delays, among other things, among the caseload issues, avoid delays that are caused by those situations where one or another member cannot sit.
Next question, right?
Sure. Representative Richard.
Mr. Chair, Corey, as you talk about this, I'm not clear the number of cases that these 5 individuals have to hear. Can you give me that number?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, yes, if you give us a moment.
Sure.
Approximately 800 a year.
Okay. Are these full? May I follow up?
Please follow up.
Are these full-time positions for these 5 members?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, yes, they are.
And do you have any idea roughly how long it takes to do an average hearing or an average review by the board?
In terms of hours spent on a particular case?
Is it a half-an-hour issue, or is it all day? I mean, I just don't have...
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I'm fairly sure we have that information, but I'll have to get back to you on it if that's okay. I believe Ms. Bach discussed that they do track actual time spent in hearings. I do not know whether they also track case-by-case time spent in the preparation work. We can get you that information.
Well, that's a point. One follow-up question is, what kind of backup do they have as far as staff? They have clerks that help prepare their cases and so forth, and do these board members merely attend, or do they do their own research? Could you give present us with information that explains what they do, how intensive it is, so that we could more accurately evaluate this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson will be happy to provide you that sort of snapshot of how they actually do their work.
Thank you.
Next on our list is would be a cut of three positions in the consumer services for the insurance division. Again, these are the consumer advocates who work with consumers on resolving complaints. This would be a the staff that works with licensing of insurance agents, which is another function within that division. This would eliminate it would cut the staff that works on that licensing. We would eliminate some of the training for insurance agents, and also proposed here is to shift some cases away from the central hearings panel, which for these cases can sometimes be more costly, and shift them to the workers' compensation board. The next, which is at the top of page 3, is a reduction in services and supplies for Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. Again, this is simply something that we would absorb. This would be something you asked, Mr. Chair, if we could identify things that would not result in direct service cuts. This is an example that would not directly result in service cuts, but it would impact in the long term our ability to maintain professional qualifications, because some of this would include participation in professional associations and training, which already has been cut significantly under administrative restrictions. The next would be a significant cut in our review of insurance rate and form filings. This is, again, not in the workers' compensation area, but in the other services that we provide. We do review insurance company filings and exercise oversight over rates and forms, and this would decrease that front-end review. A front-end review means that we can avoid problems before people buy those insurance policies, as opposed to waiting until they've bought the insurance policy and then identifying a problem when a claim comes up. The next item on the list would be a cut in, this is in the Workers' Compensation Board, not the division, their hearings division. This would close field offices in Ontario and Coos Bay. Both of these, this is a rent issue. These are unstaffed offices. We have staff who travel to those offices to provide hearing services as customer service for those parts of the state. This would also eliminate an administrative law judge position. I think we may need to get back to you on specifically which, but this is an elimination of two positions, but I see the narrative here also refers to the board member positions, and this is not a duplicate of the prior one. So these may be two administrative law judge positions, but we will have to correct this. I apologize for that. The elimination of an administrative law judge position would, the impact, service impact would be a potentially increased waiting period for hearings.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Do you have a staffed hearing office on the coast?
I'm getting head shakes. No, not a staffed office. So the Coos Bay hearings office is unstaffed, and we send staff there for periodic hearings.
And that's for the entire coast?
I don't believe we have other offices on the coast other than that one in this area.
A quick question.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
How many hearings officers are located in the Portland office?
And Mr. Chair, we're going to have to get back to you with that specific information. If we can, if it would be useful, we can outline the different field offices, staffed or unstaffed, and where they are located.
Are they throughout the state?
But one of the challenges for us is the balance between providing good customer service in throughout the state in field offices and cost cutting, frankly. So that is a challenge, and there is no perfect solution to it.
Was there any consideration of reductions to the Portland office?
Mr. Chair, this is a reduction in two administrative law judges. I do not know where they are located, but we will get that information for you. These are the staff eliminations that are part of this line item are not field office staff.
Right, but was there any occupancy overhead reductions in the Portland office, or were Ontario and Coos Bay the only two?
For this particular line item, I believe the proposed cut is for those occupancy costs in those two field offices, rather than the Portland rent. Of course,
it's a fixed cost.
It's a fixed cost, and I am trying to remember. In the Portland area, often we rent from DAS, and
we are
in the state office building in Portland, I'm told. So that DAS is our landlord there, and our ability to affect those costs is pretty minimal.
Representative Richardson.
I'm sorry, the Department of Administrative Services.
Correa, it's like, it's not necessarily a black or white thing. It says, close unstaffed field office, therefore moving the hearings to Portland, as if there's no option. I mean, there's a county building, there's city buildings, there's county courthouses, city courthouses that are not booked all the time. In every courthouse, there's meeting rooms that attorneys use for depositions. It seems like there may be, I could probably come up with a dozen alternatives in about 30 seconds to moving, to burdening the citizens to Portland merely because we're closing unstaffed, occasionally used offices. And so, you know, is there not other options that are being considered?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, we can take another look at that. My understanding on this item was that because of the hearing setup and the recording equipment and the scheduling issues, that actually finding an appropriate location for these needs with the appropriate equipment turned out to be not a realistic alternative. But I will check into that, and it may be something we need to take an alternative look at.
Mr. Chair, I just add a comment that if I'm not mistaken, people that have the workman's comp claims are sent to Corvallis or Albany or somewhere to a doctor. There seems to be quite a bit from the coast of expecting these people to travel quite a distance. They'll go and they'll get one doctor's opinion and come back, and then they'll hear from the workman's comp people that they have to go get a second opinion, and they have to go back to the valley, to the doctor. I with Representative Richardson, we need to think in terms of how we can service people in the most efficient manner. And I would certainly think, for instance, in Coos Bay, the college has a lot of setups, and they do Social Security hearings there, so I don't know why they couldn't do workman's comp hearings. I'm not so much talking about that they'd have to be in Coos Bay, but you realize, and I realize, the population centers are in the valley, but you've got to realize if you include the whole coast, you've got a lot of workers, mostly just people that probably would be under workman's comp. We still have Georgia Pacific, Wurzburg products. Those people are all covered, and all of the people up and down the coast, little mom and pop stores, all safe companies. So I have to speak in defense of them.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, once again, we think it is quite important to keep these field offices or the ability to have hearings around the state available. So I agree with you. The next item on our list is a reduction in Oregon OSHA voluntary services. Those are those consultation and training services. This would reduce our ability to provide those services to employers who need them and request them, and to do so on a timely basis. So this is an incremental cut. It's by no means elimination of the program, but it would significantly reduce our ability to deliver those services.
Corey, does OSHA have a OSHA ombudsman?
Mr. Chair, not by that name.
How do we assist a business owner with dispute? Who serves as the advocate for the business owner?
Well, Mr. Chair, of course, they can, and if necessary, they do complain to either Mr. Malkasian or myself. But in addition, if there are penalties, of course, they have a right to go through a hearings process, and that is depending on the issue through either the Office of Administrative Hearings or the Workers' Compensation Board.
I'd be really interested in seeing a cost analysis of the hearings process versus the hiring of an ombudsman in, say, each of the ODOT regions. I don't know. Do you have regions? Do you say?
Mr. Chair, we have field offices, but we are not set up in a formally regional basis.
Could you take a look at the five ODOT regions and just put an ombudsman in each one of those, and then tell? I'd like to see a cost comparison.
Mr. Chair, we can certainly do that. I should point out, and Mr. DeLucas just reminded me, we actually have a very active dispute resolution process within Oregon OSHA, which is quite successful. One of our goals within Oregon OSHA, again, is to make sure that that the result of an inspection or an enforcement proceeding is better safety. So this is an informal appeals process within Oregon OSHA, without going before going to formal hearing process. We do regularly resolve complaints. One of the outcomes we like to see, for example, is that if there is a citation and a fine, often we can arrange to have a portion of that fine diverted into safety improvements at the business.
Right.
So
the dilemma, though, is your department has all the power. And so, you know, it's an unlevel playing field, and I don't doubt the fact that you work closely and you really try and resolve these issues, but I wonder who serves as the advocate for the business owner when you get into a heated issue.
Well, Mr. Chair, again, we're happy to provide you with the information about what it would cost. I would also encourage you to take a look at our customer satisfaction surveys, actually on this enforcement side, because this tends to be a very popular process, in fact.
I think business owners would be afraid to tell you they're not happy?
I hope not, and we try to arrange for them to be able to do that in a confidential manner.
I'd like to look at just as something to pursue.
We can certainly do that.
Thank you.
We are reaching the end of our list here. And so we are now sort of at the end, the things that we would least like to do on our 10% cut list, although, once again, these aren't any of these things that we would really want to do. But the Workers' Compensation Division benefits staff. This next line item is a proposed reduction in that staff, so that would eliminate our ability to serve injured workers, to consult on benefit issues, to provide information, and to provide training to make sure that benefits are provided accurately. The next item would be a cut in oversight of workers' compensation insurance coverage submissions and audits, and again, that goes to that issue of ensuring that employers are providing coverage. And then finally, final cut would be a cut in Oregon OSHA enforcement staff. And I want to say again, as we put this cut list together, most of our costs are in our employees. Most of our employees are involved in providing direct service in our key program areas, so it's very hard to come up with a 10% cut that doesn't have some element of directly affecting our high-priority programs, and that's why you see these cuts here.
Can you show me in the Office of Minority Women in Emerging Small Businesses where your 10% reduction, how you add
yes.
that up?
On the second page, the second item on the second page is an elimination of one-half FTE, which is the Emerging Small Business Certification Program.
I think we have a map there somewhere.
Mr. Chair, we did a 10% cut agency-wide, not program by program, because many of our programs are small, and trying to do a 10% program by program cut, we did not feel would best accomplish our mission. So
when I go back through the number, I just want to be clear here. So when I go back through and add up the three different sections of Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business, their total budget will be $610,000? No, agency-wide.
Agency-wide.
Well, help me here. I don't understand how that helps us prioritize.
Well, she's saying you could eliminate this easier than taking 10% off of a bunch. She's prioritized where eliminations could take place, because this is all of this. It's all of that. It's not just 10%.
Why don't you and I follow up?
Mr. Chair, we can certainly do that. Our instructions from Legislative Fiscal Office were to, and statutorily the requirement is to do a 10% cut agency-wide.
Right.
Mr. Chair, you will see that in other agency budgets. They may choose not to thin the soup and may choose to take their reduction in one or two of their programs, for example.
Got it. Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, that concludes our review. We are, of course, happy to answer any further questions provide any other information that you feel would be useful to you, either now or in future phases.
Any questions? I think you folks have done a very admirable job, a very good job, of bringing a lot of difficult information forward, and so we appreciate that. There's things I'll want to follow up with you on, just so I have a clearer and better understanding. And I didn't open that door open to any of the other members on this committee. Any questions before we adjourn? Representative Richard.
Having sat through so many of the hearings so far, I'd like to say that I really commend you on straightforward, and this is, I mean, it's an honest attempt to provide the information for us to make difficult decisions, and that I get no sense of hiding the ball, and I appreciate it very much. I think that's very helpful for us.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson.
I think that you've been dealt a committee that's trying to learn this process as we go along, and you're a pretty complicated agency, and trying to learn this process as we learn the complications of your agency has been difficult.
Yeah.
But I think you did an excellent job.
Thank you.
Your entire staff. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, tomorrow we have Mr. Repine, Housing and Community Services. So we will start tomorrow at 1 o'clock. And with that, we're adjourned.
Do you have...